Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Mike Shackelford.
And last week, I told you tonight's guest would be Ann Fried-Lefton, a tax accountant who has made herself knowledgeable about gambling issues. I got my date screwed up, and Annie will actually be here next week. Although she could have forced herself to come this week, she was in a rather serious traffic accident not too long ago. She's functioning, she will recover, but she's currently on pain meds, and she doesn't know quite what she would say if she was on the air right now. 10 minutes ago, I got a phone call from Richard Munchkin. He says, you know, I'm in the area and I have nothing better to do for an hour. Would you like me to sit in? Silly question. The answer is yes. So welcome, Richard.
Good to be here.
He's one of our favorite. In the poker news to start with, in the past few days, there seems to be a final resolution to the Full Tilt Poker situation. Michael, did you look into that at all?
No, I forgot to do my homework on that, I'm afraid.
Ah, well, then...
So fill me in.
PokerStars has purchased Full Tilt Poker for a total price of, I think, 730-something million, some of which is going to the Department of Justice. Much of it is going to American players whose money has not been refunded yet. And in exchange, PokerStars is going to buy Full Tilt and essentially retire it. And so players are going to get paid.
So what does Full Tilt get? I mean, PokerStars get out of this?
There's a couple things. They don't know. One they get is the Full Tilt database, which presumably is the email address and the betting histories of players. They also may get the goodwill of legislatures who are looking for online gaming in the state, such as Nevada. And this is clearly investing in the good of the poker community, which I think will go down favorably. I cannot think that PokerStars did it because they're altruist. There's something that they believe that they'll make money on this deal.
Well, regardless, I'm happy to hear that the players will at least get something.
Yeah, I'm also happy to hear the players are going to get paid. I'm just astounded that they would pay that much money. I mean, that's an enormous amount of money.
It is.
But, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe they think this will give them a foot in the door in terms of, you know, being among the first to be allowed to deal online poker.
Yeah, well, 731 isn't as much as it used to be anyway.
Yeah. If I had 731 million, I'd take it down to Binion's and try to turn it into some real money.
Then you'd be too busy to be on the show tonight, so I don't want that to happen. So this week we're going to be talking about television game shows. While not directly related to gambling, it's close and somewhat related. In some gambling games, including poker, casino tournaments, and a few other table games, you're competing against other opponents while playing a game. That's exactly what television game shows are about. Often the best players are the ones who have thought about situations in advance and can bring up the correct answer on the spot rather than having to figure it out from scratch. Tonight's show hopes to give you some of those correct answers. So one of the first things we want to talk about is a classic paradox called the Monty Hall paradox that I first read about it years ago in a Marilyn Vos Savant book. It had started out as a question on one of her columns in Parade magazine and caused a controversy. It was in the movie 21. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about the Monty Hall paradox?
I'd be happy to. On the game show Let's Make a Deal, it always ended with what was called the big deal, and there were three doors, door numbers 1, 2, and 3. And they always put a really good prize behind one of them, and the other two prizes were okay, but maybe only worth half as much. And the way Monty did it was he would pick the two biggest winners up to that point and invite them to play the big deal, and they always did. And they would each pick one door, leaving one door that wasn't chosen. And then Monty Hall, the first door he opened was always one of the lower prizes. He knew where the big prize was and always left it to the end to build up suspense. Now, the way the
Before you go on, Michael, you did have two players choosing a door and him opening up the third, so there's no more mystery. So it had to be one player opening up the door and him opening up one.
He might have opened up the unchosen door first.
Okay.
I don't exactly remember, but the way this whole problem gets simplified in terms of a probability question is, say there's only one contestant, and Monty Hall still always opens up a losing door first. So the contestant picks his door, say door number 2, then Monty opens up one of the losing doors, say door number 1, nothing there. Then he offers the player the chance to switch to the remaining unchosen door, in this case door number 3. The question is, should the player switch?
That's the question.
That is the question. And almost everybody answers either it's a 50-50 thing, and when they did this experiment on Mythbusters, 20 out of 20 people stuck with their original door. The correct answer is that you should switch. You have a 2 in 3 chance of winning if you switch to the other door.
That's correct. And it's fun. And when I first heard it, I did not figure it out. And when Marilyn Vos Savant published in the paper, she got a lot of college math professors writing in and saying, "You are an idiot. It doesn't matter." And, of course, she finally was proven right. So,
well, Marilyn, I don't remember exactly what she said, but the way she presented it was really badly worded. And I think she had to write about it like 4 times to clarify the issue, because I don't think that she understood Monty's behavior or something like that. It's critical for the problem to understand that Monty knows where the prize is and always opens up one of the empty doors first. A lot of people, when they say the problem, don't say that. And it completely makes it a different problem, kind of like Deal or No Deal, where the big prize is unknown to everybody. So, and the reason you should switch, it's kind of hard to explain, but when the player chose, say, his door, before anything was opened, it had a 1 in 3 chance of winning.
Correct.
And so that means that there is a 2 in 3 chance the prize is in one of the other doors. There is a 100% chance that at least one of them is empty. All Monty is doing is opening the empty one. there is still a 2 in 3 chance the player did not originally pick the door with the prize. Therefore, it doesn't really add any pertinent information that Monty opened an empty door. If the player switches, it's like he's switching to both other doors. Therefore, it's a 2 in 3 chance of winning.
That's all correct. And it's one of those interesting paradoxes.
You know, I just wanted to add that when you say on Mythbusters that 20 out of 20 people kept their original choice, if you've ever watched magicians work, they will often, you'll pick a card or you'll pick something and they'll say, now, do you want to change your mind? And it really doesn't matter if you do or not, but just from having done magic, you find that almost never will people change their mind. They want to stick with whatever it was they originally chose.
All right.
That doesn't add any EV to the problem, but...
That's right. So Monty Hall and three-card Monty are somehow related here.
And I wonder if that's because our teachers, when we were preparing for the SAT, always said, if you're not sure, go with your first instinct. And maybe that just sticks in all of our heads.
I think also there's a psychologically, the loss of having had the right door and then giving it up is much worse than if you keep what you have and end up losing anyway.
Right. If you include second guessing in there, it may not be a good idea to switch. If you're going to be second guessing, so in that case, it may not be a good idea because second guessing may work on it. All right. Let's move on to something else. Last week, I told a story about a friend of mine who managed to find a way to cheat to get on a Jeopardy show. And in the process, milking some money off of me in a couple of different ways. First of all, because I was sure he wouldn't be able to do it. And second of all, once he did it, I had to know how he did it. And I couldn't go to sleep without knowing. So I received an email this week from somebody else's Jeopardy scam. This was a farm boy in Indiana. His name was Rich. He had a girlfriend named Vicky, who lived 10 or so miles away. By a fluke of geography, however, Rich's family... house received TV from Louisville. That's where the station was. That's the Eastern time zone. Vicky's family's house got it from the Indianapolis stations. Now, that's still in the Eastern time zone, but at least in this part of Indiana, they didn't celebrate daylight savings time. So Vicky was getting the program on Central time, and Rich would see the program on Eastern time. Now, when he was invited to dinner over at Vicky's, he knew this. They watched Jeopardy during dinner. That was a ritual at Vicky's house. So before he'd go over to Vicky's, he would watch the Jeopardy show at his house and then drive over to Vicky's and watch the show along with the others. Now, during the show, everybody would shout out answers to the questions. Rich would call out some answers, too, and he'd usually pick the wrong ones on purpose. He knew what the right answer was because he'd just seen the show, but he was really setting up Vicky's father. He had to wait until Final Jeopardy to make his move. Now, Vicky's father wasn't normally too impressed with Rich's brain power. Probably didn't think Rich could spell dog, even spotting him the D and the O. But taking advantage of Vicky's father's negative belief, Rich would always suggest a bet on Final Jeopardy. If Rich won, he would get extended dating hours with Vicky. If Rich lost, he would wash Vicky's dad's truck. The father jumped at this bet, and for some reason, he lost every time. All of a sudden, Rich would become amazingly knowledgeable about categories such as European rivers, 19th century vice presidents, Shakespeare, astronomy, or whatever else the Final Jeopardy was all about, about which Indiana high school farm boys normally know squat. In the email, Rich didn't tell me how often he was able to pull this one off before Vicky's father figured out that he was being bamboozled, but I can't believe he could do it too many times, unless Vicky's father couldn't spell dog with that spot. Anyway, it's not as elaborate as the Jeopardy host last week, but it's a good story, and I'm glad Rich sent it to me. Did you ever pull off anything to get extra dating time?
I had a teammate. You know, we used to travel on blackjack trips, and they rerun Jeopardy at some point. And because he was an avid Jeopardy watcher, he would remember the episodes. And we, I remember either last week or the week before, you guys were talking about playing games to pay restaurant bills.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we always used to play the game that Ken Houston talked about in his books, where you would have a waiter write down a number between 0 and 1,000, and then we would take turns guessing a number, and the waiter would say it's higher or lower, and it gets narrowed down, and the guy who actually picks the number would have to pay the check. But we would also bet on all sorts of other things to pay for different things, and one of them was always Final Jeopardy, and this guy on our team, Phil, you know, would often, you know, if Jeopardy was a rerun, he would basically have a lock because he had seen it and he knew what the answer was. He was a pretty good Jeopardy player as it was anyway, but...
The little edge never hurts.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an episode of I Love Lucy that is all about Ricky pulling this trick on Lucy.
On Jeopardy? They had Jeopardy back then?
Oh, no, it was another game show, and I don't remember what the title was, but Ricky was in the studio audience when they taped it live, and then they and when it finally aired on TV, it was weeks later, as they do with Jeopardy. Lucy didn't know that Ricky was in the studio audience, and he impressed her with how smart he was, and that led to Lucy signing him up for another game show. And of course, Ricky's knowledge of trivia was not very good, so I don't remember what happened after that, but I think he totally embarrassed himself.
It does sound like an I Love Lucy episode. Now, while we're talking about Jeopardy, sometimes in Jeopardy, the betting on Final Jeopardy is kind of critical. Now, if the first place guy has at least twice as much as the second place guy, then it's trivial. He just bets real small and he's guaranteed a lock to the win, because mostly all the value comes in the first prize. You get to keep the money and you move on to the next day. And second and third prizes get gifts. Not trivial gifts, but relative to the money, trivial. So, Michael, you've studied a little bit about Final Jeopardy wagering.
Yes, I get asked about this quite a bit, and it gets really complicated mathematically in the three-player case, so I thought I would just talk about the two-player case, where one player had a negative balance going into Final Jeopardy and was asked to leave. So there's a website that's all about Jeopardy with a lot of statistics, and it's a jarchive.com, I believe. And one thing they mentioned is that on average, 43.8% of answers to Final Jeopardy are correct. However, they are correlated. And if I get the question right and my opponent is equally skilled, there is a 54.2% chance that he will get it right as well. So, let's say...
You have no way to judge skill. That had nothing to do with the skill. It was just if he was the second-place player in the game.
I am just going off of... they have statistics about how often all three get it right, how often 2, 1, and 0.
Can judge skill somewhat because you've played the entire game with the other guy. You know,
right. But
this is a new category.
Everyone is equally skilled in the interest of simplicity, and the category doesn't matter.
Okay.
And I'm going to, I'm trying to simplify it to show you the point that I hopefully will arrive at without confusing the audience too much. So, in the two-player case, sometimes it's trivial if the leader has more than twice as much as the second-place player. He can easily bet small and lock in a victory. However, if he has more than the second-place guy, but not twice as much, then the second guy still has plenty of hope. And if the high player, the winning player, goes high, the low player should go low, hoping that the high player will blow it. However, if the winning player was psychic and knew the low player was going to go low, he should go low into as well and have a 100% chance of winning. So basically both players have to decide, am I going to bid high or am I going to bet high or bet low? And the way they should do this, after a lot of math, is the player in the lead should make a big bet with a 54.8% chance and a low bet with a 45.2% chance. The player in second place should make a big bet with a 64.9% chance and a low bet with a 35.1% chance after doing all the math, assuming both players follow this optimal randomizing strategy. The player in the lead will have a 69.2% chance of winning.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the players should randomize whether they bet high or low.
And exactly.
This would be based on two players who are mathematicians who understand this, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, this situation comes up all the time in blackjack tournaments or any other kind of gambling tournament.
Uh-huh.
Although... it's usually the bets are not secret. So there, you know, you have a much different, you see what the person who has to bet first has a big disadvantage.
Yes.
But some of the tournaments allow a secret bet. So you can have exactly this kind of situation.
Yes, and Baccarat tournaments normally have a secret bet at the end. So it often does become proper strategy to randomize what you're going to do.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, in my own case, rather than randomize it, I would have to sort of go with my gut about what I felt about my opponent, how sharp I thought my opponent was.
And also what your gut was about the category.
Oh, that too.
If it was European Rivers... that may not be your strongest category.
True.
If it was, so each of us, even if we're equally strong, I might be stronger in American history, you might be stronger in geography, and somebody else might be stronger in something else.
Right.
Right, right. I absolutely agree. And I was trying to illustrate a point that sometimes with these kinds of problems, you have to not be predictable and choose what you're going to do at random. And this kind of situation also happens in military situations where you might attack by the land or the sea, and you don't have enough people to do it both ways. And the defending country can either defend one place or the other. And so, again, it would be a situation where you should randomize what you're going to do.
Did you intentionally pick that example after my Final Jeopardy question? When I was on Final Jeopardy, I was in second place. And for me, at the time, it was a no-brainer to bet the farm. And we actually had a deal with the guy in first place that if it was just down to us two, which it was, that the first place would bet an amount such that if we both got it right, it would be a tie. And we'd mm-hmm. both keep the money and come on tomorrow. So there was no, but, and he agreed to do it, and I agreed to do it, and he forgot to honor that. But... So I bet the farm, and he bet enough so he had a $100 lead if we both got it right. And the question happened to be, the category was the American Revolution, and the category is during Paul Revere's famous ride, one of the two patriots he was riding to tell, one if by land, two if by sea, and that was the category. So now Michael has seen my Jeopardy, a tape of my Jeopardy show. So, did you do that on purpose?
No, I had forgotten that. But the reason I bring it up is there is a book out there called The Complete Strategist, which uh-huh. talks in great detail about what I was just talking about, but only they use a military example to illustrate their point. And they also talk about the three-option case and four and you know, up to an infinite number of possibilities.
Well, one category that isn't normally talked about in Jeopardy, and when you watch it, it's almost invisible on the air, is what your bet should be before the final round. So when time is running out, you don't know exactly when it's going to come. They give you a sign that there's 1 minute left. And so sometimes you have a choice of making a small bet or a large bet if you're the one in the betting position of, like, there might be a $600 category left and a $1,000 category left, and you could pick either one. And
or your daily double.
So that could be. And then on the daily double, if it happens near the end, it could be right to stall and to take extra time chatting with Alex or something while it's happening or afterwards, so there's no more questions. But the category, so you want to be in the lead. Your first goal is to be in the lead. The second goal is to be in the lead by 100%, so you're double. And your third goal is, if you're in second place, get at least half of what the guy has. So you're still in game if he loses and you win. So those are the three goals in order.
And all of those apply to gambling tournaments, blackjack, baccarat, craps tournaments. All those same things are really important.
Exactly. And so frequently in the gaming tournament, it isn't so much time, but that you're going to be playing 25 hands exactly. And so those hands are going to come. It isn't you're going to be playing until 6 o'clock. Whereas on the television program, there is a timer. And if that goes off, then whatever question you're on now is the last question. So it's when you're watching at home, it's like you don't really think about this is actually going on in the minds of the contestants. But the good contestants, it is. Hmm.
Yes, I seem to recall Ken Jennings trying to kill the clock when he was way ahead.
Well, if he's way ahead, he doesn't need to, unless he's only a little bit way ahead. Because if he has 15,000 and somebody else has around 7,000, well, then, yeah, now he wants to kill the clock because he's over twice as much, but just barely. And the right scenario, it could do. But if he has 18,000 as close as like 4,000, which happened in many of his thing, well, then since he has such a high probability of getting the right answers anyway, just full steam ahead. He was an amazing player.
Right, but if he's at 18 and they're at 15, he wants to freeze it before they can get a few more questions and possibly catch him.
That's correct. You're not going to be able to freeze it for two questions. You might be able to freeze it on one. But freezing each question, because each question takes, I don't know, 30, 45 seconds, something like that. But somehow, if you can engage Alex Trebek in a conversation at that point, that would be good. All right. Now, you mentioned the game show Deal or No Deal, and sometimes the strategy there is different from the Monty Hall strategy, Michael. So what did you mean by that?
Yes, I wanted to make the comparison, because on Deal or No Deal, Howie Mandel and the banker do not know what is inside the cases. So, many people ask me, if it's down, if the only amounts left are $1 million and a penny, what is the probability that $1 million is in your case? And many people incorrectly believe that it's still 1 in 26 because probabilities don't change. But that is not true. If the host does not know what is behind the cases, then the probabilities absolutely do change, and it becomes a 50-50 thing. So, but what I find interesting about Deal or No Deal is the utility of money questions. For the players that aren't familiar with the show, there's 26 suitcases, and each one has an amount of money ranging from a penny to $1 million, and the player picks one, and then cases get opened gradually by the player randomly picking them, and they open them up and cross off the amounts from the board. And then after each step, the banker will offer the player a certain amount of money to quit the game, to walk away. And the initial offers are often just terrible. They might be 20% of expected value, but they gradually creep up. And when large amounts of money are involved, when it gets right down to the end, say, two cases left, the banker offers, let's say that there is a penny and $1 million left, the banker offer would probably be about $400,000. And that becomes a tense situation for the player. Is he going to accept basically a bad offer? But, you know, $400,000 is money in the hand. Go ahead, Rich.
If I taught a high school math class, I would videotape this show and watch this show in the class because I think it is instructive for so many things. First of all, my kids, from the time they were little, we would watch that show, and it's a great way to explain expected value, right, or equity, what your equity is at a given point.
And I agree. I do that with my kids all the time.
It seems to me that the bankers sometimes, even though the players don't seem to understand it, it seems to me that the bankers sometimes are forcing the player to play on because the offer is so bad, and sometimes the offer is surprisingly good, and I think that the banker wants the player to quit because the banker knows that the player's going to lose if they keep going on. You know what I mean?
How could the banker possibly know that?
Well, the game show, the bank, they could know. I mean, they're the game show.
Yeah, but no, but they're not going to know whether the guy's going to pick suitcase 18 or 23.
No. But what I'm saying is, let's say that the guy's expected value at some point is $400,000, and there are only a few suitcases left, and the banker knows that the more he picks, the bigger prizes are going to get knocked away, and he's going to get knocked down to, you know, he only has a suitcase worth $5,000. So the banker would rather have him win the $300,000 offer. But the other thing that the game is really instructive for is certainty equivalent,
which is what Michael's talking about on the $400,000 instead of a $500,000.
Exactly. Because like the MIT blackjack team would pay their players based on the certainty equivalent. And so there is a perfect example where if you have a 50-50 chance between a penny and a million, you know your equity is 500,000, but what would you be willing to settle for? You know, depending on your personal bankroll, I would think most people would probably be willing to take 400,000 at that point. And that's what the certainty equivalent is, right?
And I think most people would be right to do so.
Yeah, given their personal situation, their personal bankroll, probably most of them would be right to do so.
We had one of the MIT players here on Laurie C. Several months ago, and she thought very little of the of the CE. Yeah. She wanted cash in the hand, the CE. Ooh, yeah. She did not like that. So, and that actually in gambling, that Gold Coast and probably the other Coast casinos have offers like this all the time, where the top prize is 4,000 and the lowest prize is, say, 250, and the average of those might be 1,200, and they will offer you $800, or you can take a pick, and all the numbers are there. And to me, it's a no-brainer to gamble it up, because the small prize and low prize are relatively low compared to my bankroll. But a whole lot of players take a guaranteed 800.
What's even more absurd is casinos will do this, and they're in the gambling business.
They will take insurance.
They'll take insurance, exactly, yes. Which is the same thing.
It is.
They're supposed to be in the gambling business. They're supposed to understand the math. But, you know, they'll have a golf tournament where a hole-in-one pays $1 million, and then they'll want to go spend $100,000 on insurance that nobody's going to get a hole-in-one. It's absurd.
Well,
I agree 100%. And a big casino here should be able to withstand a $1 million loss. But yet they go out and take these insurance policies that probably have 100% house advantage.
And I'm going to take the negative on this. And that is that it's not the casino taking the insurance. It's the head of the marketing department, because this comes out of his budget. And his whole career is based on how well he does out of his budget. So it's not the whole casino taking it. It is a particular part of it. And the incentives for the vice president of marketing might be quite a bit different than the incentives for the casino as a whole.
Well, but that's the problem with the bureaucracy of the way casinos are run. You know, when Benny Binion was running a casino, I guarantee you he wouldn't have been telling the marketing department, buy insurance so your department doesn't take the hit.
Well, he was kind of a hands-on kind of a guy.
Right.
Now, all right, back to game shows. One of the key elements in game shows is getting on the show. Now, Munchkin and I, both back in Los Angeles 30 years ago or so, tried to get on just a whole bunch of the game show. I was on four, and I must have tried out for 10 others. And one of my problems on the game show was that I was trying to get all the right answers and prove what a smart guy I was. And this happened to be the wrong attitude. Like going on, if you've ever watched Wheel of Fortune, where the players are okay at guessing the games, but basically there are no Einsteins on there. Yeah. And so if you show up as an Einstein, they're going to go, thank you very much. Don't call us, we'll call you. And so I did not have that game plan firmly in mind. I showed up as an Einstein. I was very good at word games and never got a callback. Another thing on Wheel of Fortune is they have this really dorky, obnoxious procedure in that all the players clap while the wheel is spinning. Now, I just think this is the dumbest thing in the world. But at least this part I got right. When I was trying out for the game show and the wheel was spinning, you can bet I was clapping away, smiling, no matter who it was. Like, this is the greatest thing in the world. So you have to at least play that part of the game to get on the show. When you're actually on the show, you can do anything you want, pretty much.
Yeah. When I was going after them, I just felt like it was a numbers game, that the more I went and auditioned for, the better my chance of getting on. And one of the casting people took a liking to me because I was very good at playing the games. And so I ended up being a person that would test the games, basically. When they wanted to test a new game show, I would be one of the contestants they would call to go to the studio and basically perform the show for the studio executives so they could see what the show would be like when it was on the air. But I, like you, had very poor luck actually getting on the air. The show I really wanted to get on was $100,000 Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
And when I went and played it, I mean, by far, when they had, like, somebody who was really bad, they would ask me to come back and pair with the person to try to help them out and stuff. But they still didn't put me on the show. But the only show I ended up on was at some point, 15 or I forget how many years ago, they brought back the show To Tell the Truth. And, you know, I ended up on that show as
the person who with the, or your professional gambler on that side of it.
I was supposed to be a guy who had lost 600 pounds. You know, there was some guy who had lost 600 pounds. So I was pretending to be him. And I did get one vote, one vote of a person who thought it was me.
So that got your crew $500
or
something.
Yeah, exactly. We got more money for each vote that the real person did not get.
That would have been one I passed because the payoff was not real high.
No, and the only reason I took it was because the casting person liked me and wanted me to do it, and I thought if I did it more as a favor to her that it might lead me to getting on Joker's Wild or one of the other shows.
Part of this is I don't watch daytime TV anymore. I don't know how many game shows are on there. But when I lived in L.A., a lot of them were cast in L.A., and so I could go to these auditions conveniently. Now I live in Las Vegas, and there's no game shows being hosted in Las Vegas. So I could always fly into L.A. for the interview. But my personal thing is I don't know what name to use because I don't know if being a professional gambler is useful.
It is. They would like that because it makes a good story when Alex Trebek or whoever talks to you about it. But the problem is we're no longer the right age demographic.
Yeah, well, that sometimes is a problem. And I have no ID that says my name is Bob Dancer. All my ID says something else. And
yeah, but they would let you go on as Bob. If you could get on the show, they would put you on as Bob Dancer regardless of what your ID says. Because you can show them your books and explain you're an author. But, you know, if you look at most game shows, most people are 20 to 35.
Yeah, but I'm handsome.
Yeah,
I can see he bought that one. All right. Now, Michael, there was a game called Money Drop. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes. This is another trivia-based game show where they would ask a question and four multiple-choice possible answers. They would start the player with $1 million and ask a question. For example, what is the capital of Kentucky? And then
Louisville?
Ask four possible answers, one of them being the correct one. And you had to divide your $1 million according to these answers and your confidence in them. For example, if you were positive about one answer, you would put all $1 million there. And after you placed the money, they had these things that opened up underneath or on top of where you were supposed to put the money. So any money that you put on top of a wrong answer would drop down and never be seen again. And the money that was on the right answer would stay, and you could use it for the next question. And you had to go through so many of these questions, and whatever you were left with at the end of the show is what you got to keep. So if they ask a question and you're not sure of the right answer, let's say that you can eliminate one of them, and the other two you think one has a 20% chance of being right, one is 30, and one is 50%. How would you divide up your remaining money?
Are you allowed to put zero on one of the choices?
Yes. In fact, there is a rule that you must leave one choice with nothing on it to make it more suspenseful. But let's say that you can eliminate one of the choices anyway, so that rule doesn't concern you.
Well, I would put the money in on the percent of my confidence. So if I was 50, if I thought it had a 50% chance of being right, I'd put 50% of my money on it.
Sure, that's the intuitive answer.
And it can't be right, or he wouldn't be asking the question.
No, that actually is the correct answer. If you go through the utility of money formula and do the logarithms and then do the calculus, the answer will be exactly what you just said. Assuming that you had zero wealth going into the show, the more wealth you have in your bank account before the show, the more you should more heavily weight the answers with a greater probability of being correct.
Because losing isn't such a big deal, because I don't really need the money. Sort of.
Correct. So if Bill Gates was on the show and it was a 51-49 kind of thing, he would probably just put the whole million on the 51.
Okay, well, he probably is not going to be on the show. But, okay, good, interesting. All right, so I usually ask at this point, what did we learn tonight? One of the things I learned was that a lot of places in Indiana don't go on daylight savings time. Didn't know that. Munchkin, did you learn anything?
No, I don't think so.
Michael, did you learn anything?
I learned this also from Dave Spann, who was our guest recently, but Munch seconded this notion that to get on a game show in the first place, it doesn't matter how well you would play the game, but just how telegenic you are. And I think I did not know that well enough when I was trying to get on game shows back in my 20s and failed miserably.
Yeah, and telegenicness. Intelligenicity is more to do than just looks. It can be some.
Yeah, it's not looks at all, really. It's personality.
Yeah, some people sparkle.
Yeah.
And good. And it is somewhat looks, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lori C would get on in a snap.
Oh yeah, she'd. But part of that's based on looks. Yeah, but she also sparkles.
Right.
All right. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else. Every day in August at 9:20, 10 names are drawn in the $1 million August Cash Blast. First prize every day, $10,000, or if you're there within 10 minutes, $25,000. The other nine winners get $1,000 each. Maximum tickets are earned by playing $1,000 coin in. They've had similar events in the past, but unlike earlier times, this time it's an day-by-day thing. At the end of the drawing, they throw away the tickets, and then they start filling up the drum again at 3:01 a.m. So in the past, you could accumulate tickets by showing up every day. That would give you a big advantage. Now, you're at no if you're coming into town on, say, the 21st or 22nd, you can play with no disadvantage because nobody can have more tickets than you. Now, this is Thursday number 2 of 3 Thursdays in a row where they're having these horse races at the South Point. Now, these are televised horse races that are actually televised on your slot club reader. It's about 2 inches by 4 inches, and that becomes a little TV screen. It's cartoonish. I mean, it's not a real race, but it looks like it. And you're picking colors of the jockey's uniform, red, yellow, green, blah, blah, blah. And so if you've played 25 points in the half hour preceding the race, and you're eligible, you pick 1 and 8. If your horse comes in, you share. All the winning players get a total of $7,500. Now, last week I played it at 10 o'clock. I went there after the show because it was double point day. And I put in, and there were 3 of us playing the same game, and we go, well, we shared. And one of ours got it. It was a total of $57. So it was $19 a piece. Normally, if it was $57 in 8 ways, your EV would be $7 a piece. The people who were there said they had been there all night, and that was by far the lowest number. Usually it was in the hundreds. So your EV is $10 to $15 a piece by showing up per drawing. All right. They have a senior slot tournament on Thursdays. The first entry is free, and you can get 2 more by playing. At the Palms, the weekly drawings take place Friday and Saturday evenings. 10 players earn cash. The first names called and who are there get cash averaging $1,100. Places 6 through 10 win cash averaging $300 apiece. So it can vary, but those are the averages. The PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, in August is back to Monday, Wednesday, Friday. In July, it was 5 days a week, but now it's back to 3. For the first 2 weeks, there are kitchen items that you can earn with your Play, Earn, and Win. The last 2 weeks, you can earn free play. I'm expecting the last 2 weeks where players playing a lot more to get this free play as they think is more valuable. So on what that means is the drawing will be tougher the last 2 weeks than it will be the first 2 weeks. So the number of entries is relatively smaller the first 2 weeks because the PEW awards are not quite so high. The last 2 weeks, the drawings are going to be tougher. On Thursdays, the Palms also has a senior day. You can swipe and win up to $500 in free play or a Kindle Fire. Michael, what's happening on the Wizard websites?
Not much new this week, I'm afraid.
Okay. Good.
And if that leaves us a little time, perhaps you could talk about the strategy with the clicker on Jeopardy.
With the clicker? Okay, yeah. Yes. Okay, good. I can do that. Before I do, Annie Friedlefton, tax gambling expert, will be here next week. We promise. This is 1 week she had to cancel. I said she was supposed to be here this week, and this is my fault because I screwed up. But next week she will be here, come hell or high water. All right. In Jeopardy, the audience cannot see at home, but around the board is a white neon frame. Maybe it's neon, but it's lights. And that, when that light turns on, you can click in. If you click in before the light comes on, your clicker does not work, and there is a quarter second delay, which doesn't sound like much, but it can cause. Sometimes if you watch the show, you will see people clicking, and they keep clicking before that quarter second, and they're getting all frustrated with it, and it's just really tough. Now, that light is turned on manually when, Alex Trebek says starts the last syllable of the last word of the answer. They give the answer and you give the questions there. So when he, if the question was capital of Kentucky, when they go the key part of it, then somebody is going to press that light. And then about, I don't know, 80% of the questions, everybody knows. And so, you know, at home, however many questions you get right is, you think, well, I could do well on that. I got lots of the questions right. And the answer is the ones you got right, they got right too. And you have to click in right. So getting in that clicker, getting a sense as to...
Boy, it really seems like people click in before he finishes the question, though. So
if the light goes on, they can do that. It's a manual light. So There's the guy is trying to do it. This was 20 years ago. I'm assuming the rules are the same. They may not be. He's trying to do it when he starts the first part of the last syllable. But it's manual. And so psyching out that about the person who does it is tough. And actually, it turns out the more you watch it in studio as part of the studio audience, the better idea you're going to get of how that works. Watching it at home, this is totally invisible because there's a tight shot on the board and you don't even see that white light.
Yeah, I've heard that it's still just as it was when you were on the show, and you often should click a little bit before that light comes on, or before he finishes the question.
And even though
when you're on the show, they say don't click it until Alex is done reading the question. And if you follow that advice, I think you will lose.
That was my experience. I played by the rules and did not get credit for everything I knew. Now, I don't know how many, there was two other contestants, I don't know how many they didn't get credit for either. And so, but they clicked in before me, and although I thought I clicked in right the first time it was eligible, but then I was too late. So it's tougher than it looks on at home. Now, in 2 weeks, we're having a man named Buddy Frank on the air. Buddy Frank is the vice president of slots at Pechanga Casino. That's in Temecula, which is just north of San Diego. Last week, Michael gave a trivia question on the air, which turns out to be wrong. Pechanga used to be the biggest casino area-wise west of the Mississippi, and Buddy informs me, but they've moved. There's two casinos now in Oklahoma, which opened up fairly recently, that are both bigger than Pechanga. So, Michael, stand corrected.
I stand corrected, and I'm surprised. I didn't know Oklahoma had any significant casinos.
Apparently, in Oklahoma, they do things Texas-sized.
The Hard Rock, I think, in Oklahoma City is one of those.
Have you been there?
I have, yeah.
Uh-huh, very good. All right. And in 2 weeks, we just may have Munchkin back on the air again. So we'll see. In the meantime, go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.